You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we were joined by Josh Geltzer, partner at WilmerHale, to unpack the latest National Defense Authorization Act. Alongside Elisa, Josh walked through how the act addresses artificial intelligence and what it reveals about the growing role of the executive branch in shaping AI policy as a national security matter. This week, we're picking up where we left off. Elisa and Josh focus on how executive authority extends beyond the NDAA itself, looking at outbound investment controls, the use of executive orders, and how federal action is intersecting with state-level efforts as the rules around AI continue to take shape. There's plenty to unpack. So as always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Elisa.
Let's talk about China. You know, Chinese have developed some interesting things lately that I've been paying attention to, particularly in the LLM space. Tools like DeepSeek that were immediately downloaded off the App Store. Everybody was using them. How does the NDAA really deal with the threat of China rising? And let's face it, I mean, I'll be frank. I am one of the, I guess, tyrants who believes we need a national system of primary education. I genuinely think that if you're a poor person in a neighborhood where housing prices, the tax dollars from which largely fund education, your opportunities are less in the area of science. And I think the Chinese have figured out how to sort and identify people with talents. And I don't think we're doing that. And I think it's part of the wealth disparity that we see in this country, that there's just wide pools of talents untapped by people who have no opportunities. But China is rising, and they do have a national system of education. AI learning is now part of the national curriculum. What did the NDAA talk about China's threat, and did it anticipate the fact that there are educational disparities between the United States and China, beginning at the primary school level, that just remain unaddressed by our desire to give states rights in education, which, great, have them. But what about a national system that elevated standards and provided opportunities people would otherwise not have them?
You may not find much here on that. I think you find more of a defensive posture, no pun intended, for a Defense Authorization Act. And I think probably the most directly kind of responsive provision to how folks are thinking about China and AI right now is one, again, applicable to the intelligence community, because it's in the Intel Auth Act portion of the statute, that basically says no. It says, I see, keep out DeepSeek, which is this relatively high performing Chinese developed model, but one whose data sets on which it was trained are unclear. And, you know, speaking of skewed and biased, it's unclear kind of what it's intended to be responsive in and in what ways. And so what Congress says here is something that I don't think probably the intelligence community would have been keen to do anyway, but it says, yes, make use of commercially available models, but not DeepSeek and not any successor models to DeepSeek, just in case the company tries to change its name or something like that. I mean, this strikes me as of an ilk with previous NDAAs, including one that stood up the, I think it's the 1260H list, a list of certain companies with Chinese military links that the Defense Department has been asked to maintain. I think whatever one's view of kind of these Chinese origin AI models for general use, it's probably a national security consensus that it's not what the U.S. intelligence community should be relying on, that there are sufficiently exemplary U.S.-based models, even if their own, you know, training might be mysterious, their own ways might be mysterious at times, that having the IC, or for that matter, the Defense Department, or really any part of the executive branch, I think Congress would say, if it were passing a statute with jurisdiction over all of it, that working from a Chinese-trained model is not where it wants the U.S. government to be. Again, you know, some connection here, or at least some similarity between a recent push by Congress, by the executive branch, to reduce reliance by the U.S. government on certain Chinese origin unmanned aerial systems or drones. Sense of one doesn't know how they've been programmed, one doesn't know quite what one is getting, and so one should stay away, at least if one is the U.S. government.
Let's jump ahead about 3,000 sections, because, yeah, that's how big it was. There was some talk about the Defense Production Act. a lot of American funds get wealthy off of some of this outbound investment that really benefits China. It doesn't really inure to the benefit of the American public or the country. Can you talk about what that means, how the Defense Production Act was addressed, and just kind of explain what the heck is an outbound investment review? I don't think we've really talked about that so much as sort of CFIUS inbound investment review.
President Biden issued an executive order, which was then implemented via various regulations, creating this regime of outbound investment review. The idea that U.S. funding should not go to the generation of certain Chinese sophisticated systems whose very generation might pose a national security risk back to the United States. That feels like a kind of unholy cycle. And President Biden issued an executive order setting in motion a clamping down on that. In this statute, Congress came along and entrenched that executive action in statute. That's why I say it kind of shows a bipartisan consensus and consensus across time. It's also an EO, for what it's worth, of President Biden's that President Trump had not rescinded or revoked before this. But Congress didn't want to take chances. It wanted to put it on even firmer footing and entrench it in statute, and now has done so, and indeed augmented it, I guess I'd say, a bit, including by allowing the Treasury Department now to add certain countries of concern as verboten destinations for this sort of outbound investment. So I think you're right that for listeners unfamiliar with it, it's worth thinking about it roughly, caricaturing a bit, but roughly as a reverse CFIUS. In essence, there are some money we don't think in the name of national security should come in, so to speak, foreign ownership control of certain U.S. entities. And we think there's some money that, for national security reasons, shouldn't go out, because what it's investing in China is not something we want Americans investing in. And it's, I think, quite interesting to see Congress using this increasing rarity, which is a legislative vehicle that moves every year. That's what the NDAA does. And to use that vehicle to take the step of entrenching that previous executive order in statute and actually bolstering it a bit.
You know, we talked a little bit about cybersecurity concerns stemming from AI and machine learning systems, where the algorithm sort of continues to teach itself. What is the ongoing cybersecurity concern from China that was addressed here? Or did they identify it? How did they sort of deal with that?
This falls into that category we kind of opened with, of an NDAA that's bullish on AI's potentials and concerned about risk. Again, not just risk of our own negligent use, but risk of quite sophisticated adversary use. And, I think here you see a call to the Defense Department's leadership to factor that in, to make sure that even as they're building up their own capacity to deploy and use this and thinking about ethical frameworks, all the things we've been talking about, that they're also thinking about, you know, what it means to have what are already quite sophisticated cyber operations emerging from China, bolstered and enhanced by the capacity of AI. I think we're kind of just at the dawn of seeing that, even seeing one U.S. private sector company publicly out a Chinese misuse, exploitation of its service, of its platform to enhance its malign cyber capabilities. You know, it strikes me that among the tools that the NDAA turns to on this front, in terms of thinking about what does it mean to actually use cyber capabilities and face cyber capabilities, are now statutorily mandated tabletop exercises. I say that as a big fan of tabletop exercises. I believe gaming these things out is a really good learning experience. I used to get a lot out of them in government. I get a lot out of them now doing them with clients who want to game out things. And it's interesting to see Congress call on DOD to do something that DOD really likes to do anyway, which is these tabletop exercises, and to think in particular about, in the cyber domains, what AI may do to complicate, obstruct, or generate challenging operational elements.
One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about, there has been a patchwork, and not necessarily bad ones, of laws coming out of various states to regulate AI in one way or another. Let's talk for a second about this executive order that forbid laws or regulations restricting AI. I read it when it first came out, and it's been just long enough that I don't know that I remember that much about it. But can you talk about that, what its effect is for people who may be not lawyers or just started law school and they're not clear on the effect of an executive order versus legal action by Congress?
It's, I think, a compliment to the conversation we're having about the NDAA, because as I opened with, it's one of the most notable things not in the NDAA. In other words, had there actually been federal law preempting state level AI law, and there are different forms of preemption, but just kind of pulling back from that, in general, state law can be preempted by federal statutes. But they didn't get a federal statute, those who advocated for that. They didn't get it over the summer, and they didn't get it through the NDAA, which seems to have been kind of the trigger to lead to promulgation of an executive order instead, which cannot have that same preemptive effect, at least the same preemptive effect over state law that a federal statute can. So what the executive order did, I think acknowledging that legal reality, was to try to curb the effect of existing state AI laws in certain ways. And there are a number of state level AI laws on the books. The frontier law in California that I mentioned, a law in Colorado, a law recently passed in New York. Texas has a rather comprehensive AI state level law. So these laws are cropping up. The executive order issued by President Trump in December, when it became clear that preemption wouldn't make it into the NDAA, included a few elements. One, it calls on the Department of Justice to stand up a task force to think about litigation that the federal government might pursue to challenge the state level laws. We will see what that task force is or is not able to generate by way of actual lawsuits, let alone lawsuits that prevail. But what the executive order kind of points it towards is relying on notions like the Dormant Commerce Clause or even the First Amendment as the basis for suits against presumably the states themselves that have laws that the federal DOJ wants to challenge. The executive order also calls on regulatory entities, federal regulatory entities, to see what sort of rulemaking they might do that could have some preemptive effect on state level AI laws. Now, rulemaking, in essence, can have preemptive effect if the rules are valid under federal statutes, which raises the question of what are the federal statutes on which those agencies will be able to rely to have whatever preemptive effect on state level AI laws they seek to have in order to fulfill the call on the EO. So file that also under stay tuned. And then, one other element I'll mention of the executive order, which proves that just because something doesn't make it in the NDAA doesn't mean it can't become federal law, is that the EO, the executive order, tasks the administration itself, driven by the White House, to develop federal legislation on AI. I would say comprehensive, though there are a few areas that explicitly are to be carved out and left to the states, like child safety. But it certainly will be interesting to see what proposal comes out of this executive branch, because ultimately, stepping way back, the debate in the course of 2025 at the federal level was preempting AI state law with nothing. That's why it was called a moratorium the first time this issue was raised. Whereas once there is an actual legislative proposal, the debate is preempting something with something. Now, whether that's a something people like, whether that's a something that the states find acceptable, that's a whole different debate. But it will change, I think, the contours of this conversation when it's about federal preemption of something with nothing and becomes instead federal preemption of something with something else.
The executive order, as I understand it, was intended to sort of curb anything that would prevent the development of AI technology. But I wonder if some of those state laws instead target the uses of developed AI technology in particular ways, and if they are not actually in direct contradiction of the current EO, any law that may come down, and if that is deliberate. That really there is some thought going into, look, maybe states can say, we don't want AI used in our schools this way. But at the same time, there's nothing that would constrain development of AI unless your belief is, you can't procure a system like X here. That's forbidden. And it's the procurement that would allow for the development or the influx of funds. But anyway, that's a little esoteric. Let's try to land this plane by talking about what some of these laws actually look like. But what do some of these state laws say? If you could just sort of hit a range, I know there are a lot of them out there. I wouldn't ask you to describe them all.
Well, let me start with one that has elements totally consistent with what you've just said, which is there may be, even if there is federal legislation enacted regulating AI, it may not preempt every bit of state law. And what I'm thinking about here is the Texas law, which has a number of dimensions, but part of which is quite focused on what the state government and its organs can and cannot do with AI, what it can and cannot rely on AI for. And one would think that, first of all, it's different from AI development, which I think you're right is something that the current federal administration is quite in favor of and wants to see move forward. But beyond that, I think it's questionable whether the federal government would want to try to preempt and even could try to preempt a state from determining for itself what that state government can and can't rely on AI for, what it thinks appropriate, not appropriate. In essence, a version of the kind of high risk and not high risk uses of AI we were talking about before. So that's one notable element that the Texas law really focuses on. In California, the focus is, first of all, on frontier models, those really at the cutting edge. And it's on catastrophic risk. It's not trying to sort of tackle all of AI, it's trying to isolate the kind of most horrendous imaginable scenarios, loss of life or extreme or severe loss of property. And for that, it asks that the companies that qualify provide to the state indications of how they've thought through those risks and how they've worked to mitigate them. Then you have laws cropping up in other states more focused on just transparency. I don't mean just to diminish it, but in some ways narrower, not about how you mitigate risk, not about how the state can use it, but instead making clear to consumers or even just non-consumer users in the state what it is these models do and don't do. You do have increasing kind of percolation of legislation focused on youth use of these, with an interest in some sort of disclosures by the chatbots themselves that they are, in fact, chatbots at periodic stages of engagement with them. So hopefully that's a little bit of a smattering of what different state laws and different bills still percolating do or would do if enacted in this area.
And let me just sort of address your very last point. I think I should say, that people from OpenAI have asked that the chats with these synthetic entities, whatever the AI bots, be privileged. I don't know if you're aware of that, but they're trying to get some sort of privilege declared under the law, which strikes me as absurd. And hopefully no one will take that terribly seriously. But yeah, that's very interesting. Let's move on to look, something happened in Venezuela. I don't know if you heard about it.
Indeed,
Maybe,
indeed.
yeah, I always think when these things happen, major things happen, that it's good to look at it from a national security law perspective. But in this case, I think we can sort of frame the discussion a little bit around AI because I understand, we went into Caracas to capture Maduro, but apparently there is public reporting that we took over the electrical grid, number one. So obviously I'm thinking data centers, which have to be operational 24/7. They can't come down. The other thing is, I don't know what kind of, we had boots on the ground, but inevitably, probably some of the things that we use to accomplish this were AI-driven targeting algorithms, which are supplied by major defense contractors, some of which are just blocks from my house. I just wonder, did you look at this and did you have sort of the same reaction? Like the NDAA obviously happened before this, but I wonder if there are big takeaways from what we saw here in terms of little lessons that we can glean and pull away, placing ourselves also maybe in the role of the country that would potentially experience some kind of attack in the future.
That perspective, that kind of putting ourselves in that position, I think is very wise. And I don't know anything more than what you've described, which is similar to what I've read, but this strikes me as sort of an accretion of potential technological sophistication and the vulnerabilities associated with reliance on that sophistication. In other words, the countries of the world generally rely on power grids by this point. That's not distinctive to the US. But our reliance on the internet, in some ways exceeds others and certainly did for a while. Our reliance on GPS, the more sophisticated the systems one relies on, in some ways, the more vulnerable one is if those systems go down. To the extent we've moved from a Internet of Things to, at least in coming months or years, more of a AI of things, there's a lot to be excited about, a lot of efficiencies to be gained and economic productivity and all of that. And if you are sitting in Beijing or you're sitting in Moscow and you want to think about what it means to brush back the United States or even kind of thrust it into paralysis for some period of time, you would presumably think about our reliance on these really amazing and sophisticated technologies, which are often developed for good use. They're not developed to withstand nation-state malign activity against them. So I think you are right to kind of layer on AI as the latest manifestation of the amazing rewards of American ingenuity and the fact that we're fortunate enough to have access to these technologies often sooner, more, faster, better than others, and the potential vulnerabilities that creates.
I wonder if you have parting thoughts for us after you've been looking at the NDAA. And quite frankly, you've been actually thinking about all of this stuff for a lot longer than a lot of people. Sort of looking at where we stand right now, and we're always captured in a moment, and that moment shifts. What were some of your big takeaways from this and from the EO, and sort of what we've been watching in general? What are your big takeaways here?
I thoroughly enjoy this conversation, and that's in part because it has, I think, exposed something of a dialogue between two branches. I know we don't talk about it that much anymore, given the gridlock Washington experiences and the partisanship and all that. But even as you and I were chuckling a bit about the committees and the task force and the studies and the reports, part of what the NDAA does each year is sort of lob over big picture think questions from the Capitol to the White House, and then from the White House out to the various departments and agencies, or in this case, primarily the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. And these are big picture questions. They are complex and hard, but without a lot of time, because I do think some of the questions I saw when I was in government, some of the use cases that the intelligence community and the Defense Department were interested in exploring with respect to AI struck me as responsible and in the national interest. And indeed, it would be an abnegation of duty not to try to utilize these technologies. But they raise legal questions, and they raise ethical questions, and they raise technical questions that I am certainly not the one well placed to answer. And so I hope to take what we're discussing here and treat it not as just reports that need to be written or, briefings that need to be made, but instead as a chance to like really roll up one sleeve and think of 2026, much as I think the private sector is thinking of 2026 as a year in which AI goes from being cool and shiny and new to really carrying weight at a level and in ways it hasn't yet before. I think this is Congress saying, spend time on this and put leadership energy and effort into it because it really matters.
Well, I think this has been a fun conversation, and I always like
Me too.
talking to you. Maybe we can talk again this year. Let's see what happens.
That's
My
great.
gut is we're going to have some event that's going to make a conversation with you necessary again. Hopefully, it'll be positive. I don't want anything too scary. But thank you so much, and thanks
Hopefully.
for all the work you've done on this over the years and for thinking about it, because it's always nice to talk to people who haven't just picked up the mantle and started to think. It's always great to talk to somebody who's had this on their mind for years. I just think it's helpful because there's just so much nonsense about AI right now that you really do have to fall back on grounding principles and what you say, these big ideas and big thoughts. One thing we haven't talked about, but I want to talk to you about in the future, is how we're going to integrate our respect for the Constitution and application of it through these systems. I think that's another conversation that may be longer, and I think we should have other people in that conversation, but it's one that's going to have to be had because we have models doing things that humans could not under the Constitution. And how we figure that out hasn't really been addressed well in any law I've seen, and not, I'm sure, in this NDAA either.
I look forward to it. Thank you for those very kind words. Thank you for all you do to foster meaningful dialogue on these issues. And thanks for this really enjoyable conversation.
Thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to subscribe to NSLT on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon. Like and share this episode with a friend, not because we're wild about social media, but we know how the algorithm works. And if you want to elevate thoughtful content, that's what we ask of you. Remember, our unity is a key feature of our national security. When we can't agree, we can agree to listen to one another. And part of that is having difficult conversations about trends, informing things as complex as the economy, or as mood-based as the zeitgeist, including the rapid and sometimes scary development of AI. Hey, we remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than any other, and that's a good thing as long as we remain willing to engage in critical thinking. The writer, producer, and host of this podcast is me, Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. Our editor, my co-producer, is Francis Burkham. My co-producer is also the long-suffering, ever-strong, ever-amazing Holly McMahon. Our program manager is Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney. Social media and research support comes from Alana Coopersmith. And we're forever grateful to the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. They pursue the good in the interest of national security without regard for politics or party. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.